to be on a different. Because when you finally get to the end, you see what it was all for. Then you look back and say thank you.
That's a guarantee.
Sure. In the middle, you may not see it because you don't know what it's for. You don't know where it's going to. You don't know it's going to. You get to Olam Haba, and you look back and see that everything that you suffered here brought you a certain special place in Olam Haba, and you say, "Well, thank God that He put me through that because that's how I got to where I am."
Have you heard the expression "I gained as to be born"? Yeah,
that's a Mishnah, right? Yeah, right. No, not quite that one. Al Korchacha Ato Nosar, Al Korchacha Ato Nolad. Like that one, this one. But there again, that is my son asked me this when he was 16. You know, if somebody pushes a benefit on you that you didn't ask for, why should you be grateful for it? And the answer is, you should be. When later you understand that it was for your good, you definitely should be grateful. Okay, but tonight I want to talk about something else. Let's ask. What makes a good knife? What makes a knife a good knife?
Sharp.
What else?
Good metal.
Sorry?
Good metal.
I mean, they're good. If you use the word good over again, then I'm explaining.
Durable.
Strong. Should be durable and strong are two different things, right?
Yes.
Durable means that you can use it and use it and use it, and it won't get bent, it won't get dull fast. Strong means you can put it under tremendous pressure and it won't break. Yeah. What else?
They both mean the same thing, technically.
No, I don't think so. Durable and strong mean the same thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Faster cuts through an arrow.
Surely there are other things that make a knife a good knife.
The handle?
Yeah, what about the handle?
The maker.
What about it?
It's got to be good, right?
It's got to be easy to grip. I suppose the knife should be balanced.
The metal should be
connected to the handle in such a way it's going to stay connected. It's not going to get loose. Right? Now, suppose somebody said, "Where'd you get all that stuff from? You're surely just making it up. I like knives that are dull. I like knives that are weak. I like knives that break when you use them on paper. You like that, and I like this, so who's going to make up standards? You're just making it up. It's all relative. Nobody can tell anybody else what's good about knives. It's just making it up." Is that right? Is this just made up? We all said these things. Every one of them we all agree to. Are we all making it up as we go along? We all agree on all of them. There was no fighting here. So how could we understand what it means? We say that this is a good knife, and we all sort of know, and we can think of them, and when somebody thinks, oh, yeah, that's right, that's part of this thing. Well, I want to know,
right.
Nothing so uncommon as common sense. I didn't make that up. Somebody's clever said that. Where are we getting this from? Think a little deeper. Where are we getting this?
Isn't like the answer common sense?
Just well, it's a little broad, and you could use that for arithmetic. You could use that for cooking utensils. You could use that for anything, right? I want to know what is it that's common sense here that gives you the guiding
experience. It does the best job.
It makes sense.
Does the best
that's
job.
The application of the tool.
Oh, this is a tool, and it was made for a purpose. This isn't something you found in the street or fell down from the heavens. People made this, and they made it for a purpose. So good will mean whatever features enable it to do what it was made for, whatever enables it to fulfill its purpose. Right? A good racing car. I know it should win races, right? But the features that go into winning races, we know what they are. Powerful engine, stability, good aerodynamics.
Yes.
Well, yes, it is, yeah. But I mean, how it's built, the durable tires, take turns without, splitting or sliding and rotating around. Built in such a way that the driver can control it without suffering injury or distortion of his vision or his senses, you know, and death, of course, with one of the drive it all the way to the end. And that's what makes a good racing car. So I said, what do you mean? I like big, fat, fancy racing cars that don't top 80. Well, you know, but that's not what makes a good racing car. You may like them, but that just means you like bad racing cars. That's your privilege to like them. It doesn't change what a good racing car is. Now, let's take a slightly different example. What makes a good quarterback? Now, if you aren't an American, you don't know a real game called football, so you just have to sort of imagine.
How many Oscars suggest that's
the way? Yeah. What makes a good quarterback?
Someone my side?
Okay.
Big, strong, tough.
Well, it's a little big. The fullback probably should be much bigger. And could be much stronger and tougher than the quarterback.
Shouldn't have too many brains.
Quarterback? What country are you from?
Is that different in the US?
No, but he's got to have a good arm because he'll have to throw passes.
He has to be agile.
Not just big and powerful like a fullback. He's got to be agile. He's got to be able to snake in and out. Excellent vision and coordination. Probably. Quick on his feet. How about these things? Yeah, he's got to have all the plays in his head and be able to size up the situation and figure out what play will be best. Probably should be pretty courageous because if the enemy line breaks through and pounces on him, he's going to be under a pile. Right? So he should have a certain amount of courage. These are qualities that make a good quarterback. Now, here, we're not talking about a tool, are we?
Every part of the team is a tool. Why not? Well, unless you mean like literally a tool.
Correct. I meant literally a tool. Because usually, I mean what I say literally. It's the kind of person I am. But you're right, in a way. I think you're the way you looked at it is right. He's not literally a tool. Why not? Because?
Is that a piece of machinery?
No. The knife is a piece of machinery.
Live.
He wasn't manufactured. No. A tool is something that you manufacture, that you make it, you build it, right? He wasn't made or built.
He was taught.
Okay. Maybe teaching is like instilling these things in him. Correct, maybe. But let's leave out the teaching and leave out the building and the manufacturing. So what does he have that's similar to the tool?
Purpose.
There's a purpose to what he's doing. He's got a job to do. Someone else used the word job, which was also quite good in the general sense of something to do. There's something he's supposed to be doing. That's his purpose in his activity. Okay, it's not the purpose of his whole life, but it's the purpose of his activity. He got into the game. We know what the purpose of the game is. We know what his position is. We know what he's supposed to do. And we may, and therefore, remember what language I'm talking. And therefore, since there is a purpose to what he's doing, we can tell what it takes to be good at that, to be good for that. What qualities make a person into a good quarterback? So now we have tools, and we have things that people do for a purpose. These have built-in standards. They have built-in standards. Standards that are objective. If somebody says you made it up, he convicts himself of being from the moon. Right? These are not made up. Everyone will agree to them. They're as objective as the squareness of the table. Now one more step. What makes a good heart? I mean physically now.
Olive oil.
Wait, yeah, it is good for your blood vessels altogether. I have olive oil every morning. That's my breakfast, olive oil and bread. Huh?
Sure.
I mean it makes in that sense, you know what I meant. I mean what qualities qualify a heart as a good heart? Don't use the word good over again when you're explaining good. That doesn't help.
Exercise.
No, you're talking about a cause. I'm not talking about what causes the heart to be good. I mean, what characteristics does it have to be a good one rather than a bad one?
Strong.
You understand what I'm saying? You go you go to buy a car, right? You're looking for a good car. You don't care what happened in the factory. You don't care whether they use 17 people or 13 people. You're looking at the product. Is it good now? Does it go well? Does it use, is it good fuel efficiency and so forth and so on? I ask you to look at the heart now. Don't look at what made it that way. Cheerios, exercise. I want to know what it is when you say it's a good heart. What qualities, what characteristics must it have now to be called a good heart, rather than
strong bowel?
Okay, strong, strong, strong parts. Yeah. Well,
clear vessels.
Well, look at it. That's what it has to do. But what does it have to be in order to do it well? So there's strength, right?
Clear vessels, right?
So good. The blood vessels should be clear and not be clogged. That's right.
It's got to be pumping at a regular rate.
Okay, so it's got to be connected. It's got to be connected to the nerves. Got to be connected. You know what causes it to pump is that the nerves give it a signal. And then it jolts. So every time it gets a signal, sorry, that's right. The signal is a nerve signal. The nerve signal is electrical. So it's got, what? No, because the autonomic nervous system is centered in the spinal cord. It doesn't go through the brain. Well, okay. Well, let's not talk about the definition of life. And death is obvious, right? Now we can talk about grandma who's still alive. Now we can talk about birthday parties. Okay, so the heart should be strong. It should have clear passageways. It should be well connected to the electrical nervous system. I suppose it should. Now, this is interesting. A person who doesn't know how the heart works might think the bigger your heart, the better. The stronger it is, the bigger pump it is, the bigger capacity it is.
But if your heart is bigger, then it can hold more blood and then it has to pump less. You know, less blood can break down.
Yes, all that is what you would say if you don't know. But there's a disease called enlarged heart.
Right.
There's a disease.
To a certain extent, like when you work out, your heart gets bigger. And when your heart gets bigger, then it pumps. It doesn't have to be less to pump more blood to your body.
I don't know if it gets bigger. But at any rate, it gets stronger. I don't know if it gets bigger. But there can be a heart that's too big. Enlarged heart is a disease. And then I suppose we ought to put a disease, right? That the tissue of the heart shouldn't have diseases. Okay. Now suppose somebody says, where'd you get all of that? After all, this is not a tool. It wasn't manufactured by anybody. And it's not performing for a human purpose. It's just performing, you know. The heart pumps in dogs also, and in cows. It wasn't trained, and it wasn't manufactured, and it doesn't have a purpose. Well, it chose to pump, so therefore, since it chose to pump, anything that helps it pump makes it a good heart. But it didn't choose anything. So now we've got to go one step further. We've got to jump one step further to see what could help us see why there are standards here that everyone will agree on.
Why does the heart not have a purpose?
Have a purpose in the sense of deciding to act for a purpose, like the quarterback. Quarterback has a purpose because he has decided to do this activity for a certain goal. Right? The heart didn't decide anything. The key word that we've been using so far is purpose, right? Now the trouble is, how do you project the purpose onto the heart? In the case of the knife, a human being made it and he had a purpose in mind. In the case of the quarterback, he's doing something and he has a purpose in mind. In the case of the heart doesn't have anything in mind because it doesn't have a mind. So, still we'd like to get the word purpose in somehow. How can we...
What made it have that purpose?
Sorry?
What made it have that purpose?
Well, if we say the purpose of the heart is to pump blood, I just want you to know this happens to be a deep, difficult, controversial subject in philosophy. That may sound foolish to you. I mean, why would people waste their time in this? But it is, and I'm trying to do it philosophy light. You know, I'm trying to get through it without digging all the holes. But there's a serious problem. What would I mean if I say that the heart's purpose is to pump blood? The heart's purpose? My goodness gracious, the heart doesn't think. It doesn't make decisions. It didn't choose to pump. You know, they say, how do you know the purpose of the heart isn't to make the thump thump sound in your chest? Thump thump. Thump, 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 thump. It does that, doesn't it? Quite regularly. You can listen with a stethoscope, you can hear it pumping all the time. Say, oh, that's foolish. You know, that's just an accident.
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of a knife is to sit there and look pretty on the table, but what people would agree, the purpose of a knife is to cut something.
Yeah, and if he said the purpose of the knife is to look pretty on the table, he'd probably be wrong. It's just wrong.
Yeah, well, most people would say, purpose of the knife is to cut things. Like, right. It could do both, but just because something does both doesn't mean that's its purpose.
So what makes it the purpose that it has?
Because
that's
the main
important thing
that it does. That's its job. Oh, I see. He said something else now. I don't think it's the correct answer, the knife, but it's an important insight. The knife has a purpose it has because?
Because
It is manufactured for that purpose. You could be an ornamental knife. It could be an ornamental knife. A knife is meant to just sit there as a piece of art on the table and look pretty. It could be. And then someone will pick up that knife and cut something with it, will be doing something wrong. And if somebody complains that it's dull, he's made a big mistake, because this is an ornamental knife. It's not a cutting knife. So it depends upon the purpose that the person has for it. That works for the knife, and that works for the quarterback, because he has a purpose in doing what he's doing. When you come to the heart, I think his words are the only words that fit. You have to ask yourself, what is it doing that's important? What is it doing that's important?
Keeping us alive.
That means it's keeping us alive. And it's keeping us alive by pumping the blood. Not by making the thump-thump sound.
Zeus's life is more important than a thump-thump sound.
Well, that is exactly the question. No, that is... That, that is exactly the question. If you can see, if you can see that the heart is doing something that's important, that's valuable, that's good, that's meaningful, that's needed, then, just as he said, if that's the most important thing it's doing, now I don't care whether you use the word purpose or don't use the word purpose, but if that's the most important thing that it's doing, and we can agree on that, then we can agree on standards for a good one. Because if that's the most important thing that it's doing, standards will be whatever qualifies it to do that important thing best. So if you have any values at all, any general values at all, then you can use those values to imply standards for things that could promote those values. Now, I suppose if you're talking to a person who has been bitten by the philosophy bug and he's quite ill, and he says, who says human life is of any value? What difference does it make if it's a button? And press the button on the right side, human beings live and cockroaches die. And press the button on the left side and the cockroaches live and the human beings die. I don't see any reason to push one or the other. I just close my eyes, you know, toss a flip a coin, heads people and tails cockroaches. Tails, five people. Bang, down goes the button and the people die. Right? If you have a person who's been bitten by a philosophy bug and asks questions like that, he needs therapy. But for people who will agree on at least certain general values...
Did he catch the therapy bug?
Yeah. If people agree on certain general values, like the value of human life, for them, the fact that a heart is a good heart when it has what it needs to pump well, that becomes a matter of objective standards. That becomes a matter of objective standards. Because that's the thing the heart does that's the most important. It does a lot of things. It takes up space in the chest, it weighs a certain amount, makes the thump-thump noise.
Keeps the person alive.
But it also keeps the person alive. But that's far more important than taking up space or weighing or making thump-thump sounds. Okay. So what do we got? Something that's an artifact that was made for a purpose will be good when it serves the purpose it was made for. Something which is carried on by a consciously decided purpose will be good when it suits that. And something which plays a role, which is an overwhelmingly important role, and that role, the thing plays that role better if it has certain qualities. Those qualities will be objective standards of goodness for that thing. Can we apply this to our world, to the Jewish way of looking at the world? Can we somehow use our picture of how the world works to make standards for things using these concepts? Do we have a concept of tool in Jewish thinking? That some things are tools? Tools made for certain purposes? For example. Yeah, let's have some examples. Well, I'd like one big one generally, but I'll put up a specific one if I have to.
I don't know, the proven, like by looking at the ones that work out, we have figured that
Okay.
Mitzvahs.
Mitzvahs. How about frogs? How about maple trees? How about clouds? How about mosquitoes? How about space time?
Space what?
Yeah. Space and time, if you're back 100 years. Up with the modern space time. How about all those things? Are those tools? Were they made for a purpose?
Yeah.
They're God's tools. They were made, they're manufactured, created, constantly created by God for a certain purpose. So all of existence, all of it, can be looked at as a tool, created consciously for a certain purpose. If so, then the standards that we used for the knife could apply to the maple tree, and to the frogs, to the mosquitoes. They're made for a particular purpose. Now, the middle stage, I don't know how to apply. The stage of the quarterback, I don't know how to apply, because the frog isn't doing anything for a purpose. Unless we project into frogs more than we can see on the surface, anyway. But what about the third? The most important thing they could do. What is the most important thing that a creature created by God could do? Fulfill the purpose for which it was created. What could possibly be more important than that? So if I take these two ideas, a tool that's created for a purpose, and fulfilling some important role, doing something important, from these two you can get objective standards for what makes something good and what makes something not good. And that will include people. From here you can get objective standards for what counts as a good person and what counts as a not good person. I say not good, I don't say evil. Evil is another concept. But there are certain qualities that make a person a good person, and there are other qualities that make a person less good or not good. And a person who can work towards the first one makes himself better and better. Those qualities are really objective, because they fulfill the purpose for which you are created, and they perform a function which is of crucial importance for you, and for the world as a whole. And that being the case, these become objective standards. Now, this is another way, among many, to point out to people that standards, ultimate values, are not just a matter of choice. They're not just a matter of preference and feeling and emotion. Just as no one is going to argue about the knife, and no one's going to argue about the heart, unless, as I said, he's been bitten by a philosophy bug. But ordinary, sensible people are going to agree that the function of the heart is to keep you alive by pumping your blood and not to make the thump-thump sound. When you analyze why those are objective, then you transport those ideas into our picture of the world, that God creates the world, and he creates it for a certain purpose. The same logic tells you that this is the purpose of the things that he created, and that gives objective standards to what makes a tree or a frog or a human being a good one rather than one that is less good or not good. So a person who says, well, that may be your standards, but I have different standards, is just like the person who says, well, maybe you like sharp knives, but I like dull knives. The answer to him is, we're not talking about what you like. It's true. You might like bad knives. You might like them. I don't know why, but you just might enjoy having knives that aren't good knives. But that doesn't make it any less true that it's not a good knife. They say, well, I like... Who said that... Any man who intensely dislikes dogs and children could be a friend of mine. If he really dislikes dogs and children, then he's got to be okay. said, well, you know, he'd be a friend of yours, but that doesn't change the fact that he has serious drawbacks as a person.
What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?
Yeah, okay. I didn't mean the dogs part. I meant the children part.
Yeah, I don't like dogs either.
You're right, you're right. I just meant, you know, that was this person's way of putting it. Okay, so now, everybody's with me so far?
Yes.
Good. Now, the only time you'll get into a legitimate controversy is with someone who doesn't accept our picture of the world altogether. If you don't believe that God creates the world, and he creates the world with a purpose, then you're free of our whole argument. Then the person can say, well, okay, I understand you looking at the world as a divine creation. That gives you these standards. But I look at the world as an accident. And since it's an accident, then in that way, there are no standards built in at all. So maybe human beings can build in standards, but other than that, there are no particular standards built in at all. Yeah.
How can standards be universal when, like, if you say, like, a Jew has a certain standard because they have to do this and you have to do that, but, like, where even if you're keeping someone who's living in it, you have different standards. You don't have to do the same thing as a Jew.
Okay, this is a very important question, and even though it's a little off the subject, but because it's so important, I want to answer it. I'm running IBM. I know it doesn't look like it because I haven't got $100 billion. But all right, you know, this is my secret life. I'm running IBM, and I have rules for employees. I have rules for vice presidents, and I have rules for branch managers, and I have rules for production analysts, and I have rules for computer technicians, and so on and so on. I have one book of rules. One book of rules. They all came from me 25 years ago, and I've never changed them. But of course, I have lots of different kinds of employees.
But it's also different standards for different employees.
Well, you may call it that, but you can also see that it's one set of standards. And as a person rises up through the employee ranks and goes from job to job, a different chapter of the book will apply to him. So whether you call it different standards or not, I think now is a matter of semantics. You can call it different standards. The point is that a position in life and a job in life has standards for what needs to be done. If I take a knife and I take a wrench, the wrench is going to have different standards for being a good wrench than a knife is for a good knife. But if I'm a handyman, I need a knife and I need a wrench, and each one has standards as part of my toolkit.
Sure, but what happens when you have a specific thing that can't be changed? Your straw can be changed into a lady, and a lady can be turned into a coin. And there are different standards for those.
Correct.
So at no point can someone who's not a lady or a coin change it to the other category. So
right.
Therefore, for those different categories, it's different standards.
For the categories, there are always different standards.
Yeah,
the question is, what does that mean?
A woman can't become a man.
The question, yeah, that's
but
right.
You're saying about yes, they can. So what I'm saying is, you're saying about how if you move up the ranks, then a different set of rules apply. But in Judaism, like, I can't become a Kohen tomorrow.
Right, that's right.
No matter how hard I try.
That's right.
So certain rules that they have will never apply to me. So wouldn't you say that God has different standards for the Kohen than he does for me?
He does in a way. The question is what that means. Does it mean that he has different standards for Reuven Schwartz than he does for Reuven Katz? Or does it mean he has different standards for Yisrael and for a Kohen? Those are different statements. One is that I have different standards for different jobs. Yes, in some cases jobs can be switched from a person switching job to job, and the other case the person can't switch from job to job. But the standards are for the job, not for the person. Now, of course, the person works at a job, so of course the standards of the job will apply to this person. But they're not tied to his DNA. They're not tied to his to you know to uh, to the to something that's specific to him, they're tied to a category, and the category is defined by a job.
But aren't they tied to his DNA? If John Cohen has a son, his son is going to be Cohen like him. So it's tied to his son, regardless of what his son is before, as soon as he's born.
Well, it isn't really tied to his DNA because, first of all, if John Cohen, God forbid, has a child with a non-Jewish woman, he won't be a Cohen. And number two, if he has a child with a Jewish woman, the mother's DNA doesn't count at all, only the father's DNA he has. So it probably isn't a matter just of DNA. Certainly not biologically, it's not a matter of DNA. And in the mix and shuffle between mother's and father's contributions to the child, if it will be in some cases less of the father and more of the mother, it doesn't make him less of a Cohen. It isn't really tied to the DNA. But the point is that although it is tied to certain persons, the question is what is tied? What is tied is a job. And that job has certain roles, has certain rules. Of course, certain people may be chosen for a job because of who they are. That's true. A person can be chosen for a basketball player, he's not going to be 5'6". It's going to be something else, right? So it's true that a person can be chosen for a job, but the question is, what motivates the standards, the person or the job? There's no way to motivate standards for a person without talking about the job. Where do standards come from? What did we say? The standards come from the purpose. The purpose or the valuable thing that he's doing. So I love to look at this person and say, for what purpose was he created? And what valuable thing is he doing? And that's where the standards will come from. That's the job. That's not anything other about him other than this is the position he's in, the job that has to be done. So the standards are for the job. Yes, people do jobs. And of course, a person does a job, he's going to have to live up to the standards of the job. But the standards are for the job, not for the person. Now, this means that, as I said, the only real kind of debate you can have is where a person says, I don't buy the whole picture. If he doesn't buy the whole picture, he's got to look for his standards elsewhere. And he can find it. Just as I said, everybody agrees that human life is very important. And, you know, the person who says no is the person who's saying, I don't see what's wrong with killing people. And he probably, as I said, needs therapy. But and since people will agree that human life is important, and they'll agree that happiness is important, that pleasure is important, that pain is important to avoid, keeping your promises is important, they will agree on many things that are important. So they can have standards. Their standards aren't going to be the same as ours, because we have an extra fact, capital F, gigantic fact, that God creates the world for a purpose, and that affects our standards very substantially. But the way in which the standards come in is the same in all cases. You've got to have a purpose, or you've got to have a sense of importance, and from the sense of purpose, the sense of importance, the sense of the standards come. Now, as you could imagine, if you have the facts on board, and you take your standards from there, you're going to be quite different from the standards that people have if they don't have the facts on board. People who don't have the fact are going to draw their standards from another set of values, another set of purposes, or what's important. And then the standards are going to clash. But what's important to see is that the clash is only because we have a different fact that we start with. That's what causes the clash. Not because we have different moralities, not because we have inherently different values, but just because we're starting with a different fact. I'll give you an illustration of this, which hopefully will make this vivid and clear. Now imagine, I ask people who are not religious to imagine this. You can think back to when you weren't religious, or you can try to put yourself in the mindset of a non-religious person. This usually works. That person, imagine standing at the foot of a mountain with 3 million other people, and there's a spectacular display of fire and cloud and smoke, and the ground is rumbling and roaring, and the sound of a shofar. And all 3 million people here keep Shabbos. Okay? And you're one of them. You could compare notes with the other people. Wow. Keep Shabbos. Now, 6 days later, it's Friday afternoon. Could you just ignore that experience? What are you going to do on Saturday this week? I don't know. Haven't thought about it. But I'll think about it later in the week. It's Thursday. What are you doing on Saturday? Well, I'm considering the ball game, swimming, you know, maybe I'll build a fire and cook hot dogs in the backyard. Say, well, what about what happened 5 days ago, you know? What about that? I said, yeah, what about it? Yeah, I did, you know, I had an interesting experience, but it really doesn't matter. You know, I'm not thinking about it too much, just not relevant. I think it would be hard to ignore. You heard from the creator of the universe, keep Shabbos. Could you just ignore that? Could you say, it just doesn't matter, I just, you know, I heard it, but I have other things to think about. That's pretty hard to imagine. Okay, so now you say, yeah, but I didn't hear it. So what? Is it really so important that you hear it? Or that somebody else hears it? Suppose you knew that somebody else heard it. Another 3 million people. Could you say, oh, well, if I had heard it, then I would take it seriously. But if those 3 million people heard it, you know, it's nothing to me. But you know that the creator of the universe spoke to 3 million people and told them all to keep Shabbos. So you know that's what the creator of the universe wants. I think it's very hard to ignore a fact like that. If so, the only escape is to deny the fact. That's why there's so much controversy. Did Sinai happen? Didn't it happen? Is it a myth? Isn't it a myth? Maybe it was made up. Maybe it wasn't made up. Why? Because people know in their bones that if it wasn't made up, that if it really happened, then they're going to have to do something about it. There are facts that are so overwhelmingly important, they don't leave you, realistically, any option to ignore them. Now, if anybody listening to this tape has been hypnotized by Hume, and is hypnotized by the ought-is gap, and doesn't know how you can get from an is to an ought, I'm just telling you, it's a mistake. The whole thing's a mistake. Of course, you can't deduce an ought from an is because it's different vocabulary. But whether you can make a logical transition from a certain type of an is to a certain type of an ought, non-deductively, like saying that my brother must be male, which is non-deductive, and yet is certainly a very good transition, that is not attacked by Hume at all, and many, many philosophers have come to see that this idea that there's an unbridgeable gap between the is and the ought is just a myth. William Frankena wrote an article, I was just using his idea. He said, if you have a button that will blow up the world, you cannot be indifferent to pressing the button. You cannot say, it makes no difference whether I press the button. It's a matter of choice. There's nothing right or wrong about pressing the button. Blowing up the world is a fact too big to be ignored by your values. So there are facts that are... Well, it's true. A person could be colorblind and not see colors. There are, as I've mentioned a couple of times, psychopaths. A psychopath does not perceive other people's pain. A psychopath is the kind of person who takes a knife and says, well, where should I put the knife down? I can put the knife into the table. I can put the knife into the cheese. And I can put the knife into the person's arm. I don't see any difference, except when I put it in the arm, it makes red stains, you know, and it gets noisy. When they put it in people's arms, it gets noisy. And I guess that's maybe, you know, a detracting factor of putting it to the arm. But the screaming and yelling to him means nothing because he doesn't perceive someone's pain. He doesn't perceive it. That is called a psychopath. So you can have people who are lacking certain human capacities this way. Yes, you definitely can have people like that. But anybody who appreciates what values are, person who's not lacking the concept of value and the sensitivity to value cannot ignore a fact like that. In fact, ignoring a fact like that would be very good evidence that he was like a psychopath, that he just couldn't appreciate what values are. So this really becomes the heart of the difference. And that's why some of us work hard to give good reason to believe in the fact, because... If you have the fact on board, then these standards and these values are going to follow. Yeah.
Is there any difference between refusing to believe and denying the fact?
The only difference I can think of, using your words, is this. A person could say, I refuse to believe, but I don't disbelieve either. I'm sort of an agnostic. I'm in the middle. Whereas denying the fact will have to mean that he disbelieves, he says it's wrong.
Yeah, someone who doesn't say, you know, I don't believe what you're saying is true, but they just don't want to believe, you know. Very nice, you have the five books of Moses, if you do, you know. Keep it up, keep the good work, but they're not necessarily denying the fact. We believe something else. You believe that, they're not denying that. Not denying necessarily what you're saying.
I don't get it. They do believe Sinai happened, or they don't?
Let's say they don't believe Sinai happened.
They're denying the fact.
They don't necessarily believe it happened.
They just don't care.
They don't care.
I don't believe that. You know, it's like saying you're getting a doctor's report. And you say, well, let's see, does it have written here, God forbid, cancer or not? I don't care. If he says that, you can say, I'm not dealing with people who aren't serious.
But wait,
sure, you care. Everybody cares about cancer. I mean, you can't say I don't care about cancer. So, you know, people can say what they want, but they're not serious anymore. The person says, maybe it's true that God created the universe and he has a certain purpose for it, he's leading it to that end, but it's just, you know, it doesn't concern me.
You tried to compare the fact of the 3 million people who were standing on the mountain, somebody who wasn't still won't deny the fact. That's basically...
No, what I... I was talking about something else. I wasn't talking about denying the fact. I was talking about claiming the fact is irrelevant to him. He doesn't care about the fact. And I said, a person who's, if you agree with me, then a person who stood there and heard it and experienced it will be affected by it. And I will say later, well, that's very important, then I better change my plans for the weekend. Another person who wasn't there, but knows that 3 million people heard it, will also change his plans for the weekend. Changing your plans for the weekend doesn't require that you actually heard it. All you have to know is that the creator of the universe said so. Whether he said it to you or said it to other people, if he said so, I'm going to change my plans for the weekend. If somebody says, I know he said so, but it just doesn't interest me, then there's a short circuit there. You know, maybe he doesn't care if he dies the next minute also, but that's not serious.
Is that basically saying that most secular Jews refuse to deny the fact?
Of course, that's what I said. That's why there's so much denial of Sinai. That's why they say it didn't happen. Because they know in their bones that if they agree that it happened, they've got to change their plans for the weekend.
Of course. They agree it happened. Well, I think that's the difference, is that like most secular people don't even want to put any thought into it, whereas if there's something that has to do with cancer, that directly affects them. So in their minds, they don't really believe that whether or not there was a revelation at Sinai...
Shall I make the bitter comparison that I make all the time? Why is it that so many smokers don't do any research on the terrible effect of smoking? Because they don't want to know. Because they realize that if they'll find out and take it seriously and put it in their minds, they're going to be very uncomfortable smoking, and they don't want to be uncomfortable.
Also, most smokers do know that they're doing something that's harmful. But they don't care.
Well, I don't.
Not that they don't admit that they don't care. They just, you know.
And they don't focus on it, and they don't go to, and they don't look up things, sites on the internet about it, because to be right reminded about it is too painful. Correct. But the truth is, most secular Jews today have been so brainwashed by ignorance that, and in America, they don't give it any thought because the whole culture doesn't take it seriously altogether. But if the minute you would suggest it to them, the resistance will be there because they perceive that if it's really true, they're going to have to change their lifestyles, and they don't want to change their lifestyles. Yeah.
I was just thinking, isn't there a difference between the person who sees the cancer, sees the chart as it says cancer and says, I don't care, as opposed to somebody... It's supposed to go up to somebody in America, a secular Jew, and tell them about the five books of Moses and what it says, and then saying I don't care. I mean, or not I don't care, but maybe I don't understand. I mean, most secular Jews don't even understand, don't even know what the five books are. Whereas somebody who has cancer, everybody knows.
There's a crucial difference here. If you tell people what the five books of Moses say, they've already got this categorized. They have their blinders on. They hear, oh, another false religion with its false story. So I'm doing anthropology now, or I'm doing study of primitive systems. And this is a Jewish primitive system, and that's a primitive Zulu system, and they don't take you as telling them the truth. They take you, if you go to a secular Jew and tell him this is what's written in the five books of Moses, his response is, oh, those are the primitive Jewish beliefs that people used to have thousands of years ago, and things that modern people have outgrown, because we know they're not true. So of course he doesn't care. Of course he doesn't care. Because it isn't true. But the minute you tell him, this is a book of truth, and this talks about what happened in history, and that actually 3 million people heard the creator of the universe speak, then you're going to get tremendous resistance. He just starts off with the assumption, of course it's not true. It's a fairy tale. I listen to fairy tales. I read them to my children. When I'm tired and I need entertainment, I read fairy tales. That's no challenge to me, as long as it's a fairy tale. But the minute you assume that it's true, then you're going to get a different story. That's how they protect themselves. They protect themselves by making it into a fairy tale. But from that, you see they need the protection. I have one last point to make. Yeah?
What I was going to say was how you say people automatically jump to the conclusion that, well, pretty many people couldn't possibly have witnessed it. There's another possibility that someone could just say, well, people witnessed it, but it wasn't necessarily created in the world.
There are lots of things. Maybe it was Moses with loudspeakers and he fed the peyote. They think of all these things. I get this on my emails all the time. But it's a defense. It's a way of defending yourself against the facts. Now, the last point I want to make is this. You have a person who's doing something wrong. And he rationalizes. He rationalizes. I know there are these dangers, but they don't apply to me because I'm different. Or I'm taking some safeguard, you know. Smoking won't bother me because I say Shema. Or something like that. Whatever it is, he rationalizes. The fact that a person rationalizes, is that good or bad? Is that something which is a hopeful sign or a depressing sign? Does that give you some feeling that there's possibility of progress? Or you say, guy like that, you know.
It's a good sign.
So forth. Why? Why is it a good sign?
Because if you're not rationalizing, you don't care regardless.
Okay. Number one. That's a good point. You see? A person has done... I met a guy, I'll spare you the whole story, but the bottom line was I said to him, are you perfect? And he said, no. I said, what are you doing to make yourself a better person? And he said, nothing. And I said, what? You know? And he said, listen, Rabbi, I accept myself as I am.
Oh, yeah.
I sleep well, I eat well, you know, my life is smooth. I accept myself with my faults. This gave me an insight into something my Rebbe had told me years before. My Rebbe told me, for certain people, a person who confesses his crime is very far from improving. Now, I thought, tshuva requires you to confess your crime. So, he's already starting the process of tshuva. And in my simplicity, I thought, how could that be? But then I realized this is what he meant. There are people who confess their crimes and shortcomings very easily. It doesn't cost them anything. Yeah, it's true, I steal from time to time, but you know, look, the taxi drivers don't put on their meters and the politicians take bribes. Everybody's stealing, so this is my excuse. Yeah, I do it, you know, no problem. Right? But, as he said, if a person rationalizes, then the underlying premise is, I want to be right. I want to be right. So, I got to think up an explanation. So you think of that explanation. What will happen if you deprive him of that explanation? He'll probably look for another one. But after a while, he may get the feeling he's running out. And then he'll have to face a crisis. He'll have to face the fact that he's failing. Whereas a person who doesn't rationalize, as he said, doesn't care. So a person who rationalizes, that's a good sign. Not a bad sign. A person who rationalizes is a person for whom there's hope. Whereas a person doesn't rationalize at all, then... It's very difficult to get through to him. So when you look at people, you have to realize that rationalizing means the person recognizes how the values go. And people who defend themselves against Sinai because they perceive that were Sinai true, they'd have to change their lives. These people are rationalizing, and that's a very good sign. That's why when you get these people who fight you, you should feel encouraged. These are people who are still alive as the person. The Rebbe that we were close with in Baltimore told me once, if you are walking down the street and you see one person walk up to another person on the street and slap them in the face, you know that they know each other. They're not strangers. So, you know, take a position and another Jew comes up to fight you and say, no, it's not true, it's made up. You know each other. You're on the same wavelength. Only, he's struggling to get away and you understand that there's no way to get away. I mean, it's the person who walks by and says, so what? That's in much more serious trouble. All right? That's a little bit of our standards.
Yeah. All right.